Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Oh, mercy, mercy means all things and what they used to be. Now, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy means.
Marvin Gaye's iconic clarion call on the environment, Mercy, Mercy Me. It's an Earth Day family meeting on the Brian Lehrer Show today. Now the portion of the program we call Ask a Climatologist. No politics, no false equivalencies, no fake debates, just the science. Call in if you have a global warming or any climate science question for our next special guest, Catherine Mock. She is co-director of science for the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, that's been making headlines with its recent reports that reassess the global warming threat. She is based at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. And Dr. Mock, thanks very much for doing this with us. Happy Earth Day and hello from New York.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
And I see our lines are already full, so we'll get to callers in just a minute. And folks, you can call in when people finish up and drop off their line at 212-433-WNYC. Anything you always wanted to ask a climatologist but didn't have one over for dinner. Let me just start by asking you this. The IPCC is comprised of an astounding number of scientists. Can you rattle off some of those numbers?
Yeah, sure. So the IPCC has finished its fifth comprehensive look at all of the science on climate change. And that report came out in three parts, two of them released in the last 3 weeks. And looking just at the volume on the impacts of climate change, over 700 experts worldwide contributed text to developing that report. They cited in total over 12,000 scientific references. And importantly, reviewers from around the world submitted over 50,000 comments suggesting ways that they could improve the science in that document. And each one of those received a written response by the authors of the document.
Let's go to our phones. Yvonne in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Yvonne. Ask a climatologist.
Yes. Good afternoon. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was concerned and a little confused by what seems to be opposite processes. The more and the minimum is supposed to be making colder winters regionally, and yet the oceans are getting warmer, and I know that if it gets warm to a certain point, it starts releasing methane from the ocean floor. I was wondering what is the current understanding of that, and what is the time frame that we're thinking of if one is known about the ocean getting warm enough to release methane?
Great. So thinking about the climate changes that have happened to date, we definitely know that they're having widespread impacts, especially through the oceans, as the caller describes. And moving forward, thinking about how climate change will affect the world in the future, it's really about managing risks. There are many risks that will get worse as the climate grows more different from today due to our continued emissions of heat-trapping gases. And some of those risks are pretty complicated. The climate system is vast. It boils down to physics, so we can wrap our head around it scientifically. But there are things like feedback, methane release. There's potential for large-scale changes, ice sheet loss. Many of these are low-probability events that will be really hard to predict exactly when they will happen and when. They could sneak up on us, but they're an important component of the risk landscape, thinking about what climate change may be in the future.
But the IPCC report labels all its conclusions with degrees of confidence. I think that's important to know. So, for example, you conclude with only medium confidence that the effects on human health so far from climate change is relatively small compared to other stressors. But you conclude with very high confidence that impacts from some of the recent extreme weather events, such as heat waves and droughts and floods, with very high confidence that those reveal significant exposure to climate variability. So why do you have different levels of confidence in that than the impact on human health?
So that is absolutely correct, that every statement that appears in the summary for policymakers in an IPCC report has a label that indicates the expert's assessment of confidence in that statement. And indeed, there are some statements made with very high confidence. So the statement you pulled there, we know from extreme events happening around the world today that we're not very well prepared for the current climate. And that's really important in terms of thinking about future risks. But then, in terms of thinking about some of the impacts happening in human systems, society, health outcomes, food security, all of those outcomes are affected by many different factors. Society changing at large, population growth, where people live, technology change over time, governance. And so it can be harder to pull out the exact signal of climate change in those changes. So, for example, we know that there have been some changes in health outcomes to date due to climate change, but we have a little bit lower confidence as compared to what we know looking at our susceptibility to harm in the context of extreme events.
Matt in Connecticut, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I was looking up some information. I was finding some stuff from Dr. Francis from Rutgers. I was wondering if you could explain exactly how climate change can cause extremes at both ends of the weather spectrum, both warm and cold.
Related to our previous question, and I think a lot of people were confused, and we did a separate segment on this on the show during the cold winter, on the theory that the polar vortex was actually a side effect of global warming, making it colder here than it has been in recent winters. So I'll throw that into Matt's question of how does climate change affect both warm and cold weather?
Great. So when we think about the warming of the planet, we think about sometimes these average trends, global temperature creeping up to date 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. But in terms of thinking about what that means for impacts for people around the world, it often comes down to extremes. And there we can't just think about the average warming to date. We need to think about the entirety of the climate system. So some of these extremes, like coastal flooding, we know that with sea level rise and changes in storm patterns, there are many areas of the world that will see higher coastal storm water levels in the future. We also know that patterns of precipitation have changed to some degree to date in terms of heavy precipitation, and places that already get heavy precipitation may get further heavy precipitation, heavy rain in the future, and that can be correlated with inland flooding. We have very high confidence that heat waves, extreme heat, are changing. So just to think about, in my childhood, what was the single hottest day, a 1-in-20-year event by the end of this century, could be happening every year, every other year. So thinking about climate change in the future, it's really about risks of extremes changing. And it's very hard to say exactly what will happen in any given location at a specific time, but it's about these changing risks.
And related to that, your report concludes that human influence on the climate system is clear. Yet determining whether such influence constitutes dangerous anthropogenic interference, that is, dangerous interference by people, involves both risk assessments and value judgments. And I was curious why you included value judgments, which might not seem to be a scientific measurement.
Great. So we as people are really important in understanding and determining what is danger in the context of climate change. So we've got a changing climate system. We know that greenhouse gases are at the highest concentrations they've been at in 800,000 years. We know that the last decades have been the warmest on record. You know, we can reel off all of these facts about how the climate is changing. But is that dangerous? And is that dangerous requires a careful look at all of the risks that this changing climate entails, and it also requires a careful look at how people perceive those risks and the judgments they care to make. So the grand finale in our assessment of risks is really five reasons for concern, and these are different ways of taking a global perspective on the climate change challenge. And some of those are really about unique and threatened systems. So if you care in terms of your values about things like coral reefs, Arctic sea ice systems, and the associated cultures, risk could grow quite high in the near term. Another reason for concern thinks about the risks of extremes. You can also think about risks for the most affected by climate change, and you can think about risks associated with the low probability, high consequence events like ice sheet loss, loss of coral reefs. So in terms of which of those reasons for concern you value most, it really boils down to values, worldviews, goals, what you're hoping to achieve. And as people across the world, we have many commonalities in terms of what we care about, but we also have some slight differences, and that's really embraced in the assessment of risks.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. It's an Earth Day family meeting here on The Brian Lehrer Show, our Ask a Climatologist segment, right now with Catherine Mock, co-director of science for the International Panel on Climate Change Working Group Number 2, which means she helped lead on that IPCC report recently that's been making headlines, reassessing the global warming threat. She is based at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. And let's take a question from a self-declared global warming skeptic. Mike in New Jersey, in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Well, I would beg to differ with that characterization.
Oh, I thought you told that to the screener. I'm sorry.
No. The question I have is this, and I'm skeptical in the sense that there's a missing piece of these explanations that makes it harder for me to believe what you're saying. So I'm asking you to fill it in. In my mind, at least, the question that that climate change occurs is, of course, all right? And obviously it's been going on for as long as the Earth has existed. I mean, we used to be under glaciers here. We used to be under a couple hundred feet of water. What I don't hear in all these discussions is the interaction of those mechanisms that have caused climate change from time immemorial with human activity. All I'm hearing is about what human activity is doing, and I don't get the sense that you folks are either, I assume you understand it or just not explaining it, how that's affecting what would be the normal trend in climate change absent industrial activity.
It's a great question. So, Dr. Mock, how do you, as a climate scientist, pick apart human impact from climate change that might be going on anyway in cycles that existed before industrialization?
So much of the climate science that underpins the Working Group 1 report, which really said, what do we know about the changing climate, does dig deep back into deep, deep time to understand how changes in these greenhouse gases were correlated with changes in temperature hundreds of thousands of years ago through to the present time. And what we know is that the current change that we may see through the century with continued high emissions of greenhouse gases is really unprecedented in a lot of different ways in terms of the rate. You know, changes that happened over a millennia in the past, we might see over a century. And we know that in the deep, deep past, some of those changes that did happen over millennia caused big extinctions of species. And from that, we can understand that the current rate of change is serious. It poses real risks for biodiversity, for human systems. At the same time, we have choices, so we don't necessarily need to head along that trajectory of continued high emissions. Ambitious reduction in emissions can take us to what would be a much safer level of climate change. At the same time, we, no matter what we do in terms of emissions, have some warming that is baked into the system in the next few decades, and we want to make sure we're prepared for that.
The coverage in the media of the latest IPCC report, compared to the last one a few years ago, makes it sound like scientists are more certain today that certain effects are headed for the dire category. How would you describe the biggest change in your assessments in this report? I see you were also involved in the one that came out in 2012. And how much would you call it worse in terms of what you're now able to measure?
It is definitely the case that over the past two decades, as the IPCC has been doing these assessments of the science, what we know overall, the volume of scientific literature has grown enormously. So compared to the last assessment, we can definitely say that there are many impacts of climate change we can now identify in human and natural systems around the world. So that is a big advance. We have had more time to look at it, and there's more science, and the climate change signal is becoming increasingly clear. You know, another kind of neat advance in the current assessment is really that it used to be that preparing for climate change, adapting to the impacts of climate change was somewhat of a hypothetical. But today we actually see governments, people, communities, firms around the world already preparing for the impacts of climate change. You could point to specific topics where there's been big increases in literature, the ties between climate change and conflict, really understanding the societal underpinnings of vulnerability, the multidimensionality of what makes us susceptible to the impacts of climate change. All of those are areas of big increases in literature as well.
Susan in Westchester, you're on WNYC. What would you like to ask a climatologist?
Hi. Yes, yeah, so my question involves a report that I looked at by the UN that said that I remember saying that meat production outweighed greenhouse gas production in terms of all transportation. I'm not sure whether it was here in the States or whether that was a global assessment, but also the fact that people are choosing around the world to eat a lot more meat in places where that wasn't the case previously. So that's really the nutshell of my question.
Thank you. Does the IPCC measure that, Dr. Mock?
So the Working Group 3 report that was released last week in Berlin takes a really careful look at where emissions to date are coming from. And what we definitely know is that emissions over the last decade have continued to rise rapidly. We definitely have not turned the tide on those rising emissions, and in fact, they're going up faster than before. In terms of where they're coming from, it has to do with all aspects of our life, really, you know, our energy supply, our buildings, indeed, our agricultural systems, how we use land, what we grow, whether that's livestock or crops. And all of those different factors contribute in different ways to the emissions we're seeing right now.
So, for example, would the IPCC have any information that would tell us if we're interested in eating sustainably, whether a locavore imperative is more important or eating vegetarian? I know those things are not necessarily either or, but there are people, you know, in the sustainability movement having this conversation. Is it better to eat meat if it comes from a relatively local source than vegetables that have to be imported from further away?
So I think you'd want to do a careful counting of your emissions, probably at a finer scale than a global report can get at. But what we did find for sure is that if we continue along a trajectory of high emissions through this century, heading towards 4 degrees Celsius increase, which is, you know, over 7 degrees Fahrenheit, the risks for food demand or risks for food security are substantial. But it's not just the fact that climate change will be weighing down increases in crop yields. It actually is, importantly, also resulting from increases in food demand associated with growing population, but also more and more people around the world starting to eat like us as Americans.
Tim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. What's your Ask a Climatologist question?
Good morning and happy Earth Day. My question is, what percentage of the carbon humans are going to release in the next 30 years would come through the Keystone Pipeline? And how much of that is going to get released anyway, even if the pipeline isn't built?
It's a great question. I'm not sure it's in the purview of the IPCC. Is it, Dr. Mock?
I know that there are careful analyses of the Keystone Pipeline ongoing. It was not in our report. I think moving forward, we know that reducing emissions will require a whole suite of activities, ideally by countries around the world. And if the more people act sooner rather than later in reducing emissions, the cheaper it is to solve the problem. And the solution involves continuing to increase our usage of renewables, as we've been doing over the past few decades. Improved energy efficiency will also play a really important role, as well as really scaling up carbon capture and storage, pairing it with bioenergy. So there are a whole suite of technologies that we want to have on the table and moving into action.
So part of the implication of his question is, I think, from an argument that the supporters of Keystone use, which is it's either going to go here or it's going to go somewhere else. If the U.S. rejects this pipeline, Canada's going to develop its tar sands anyway, and they're just going to sell more of that oil to China. Or elsewhere through other means. And so there wouldn't be a net reduction in the amount of carbon load if the U.S. rejects this particular pipeline. You don't have an answer to that question, right?
I won't dive into the specifics of that question, but I think what we do know is that climate change, as you're getting at very directly, is a global issue in terms of its impacts and in terms of its origin. And, you know, the report out last week does find that something like a global price on carbon can be a very efficient way to address some of these interlinkages in terms of making it something that's realized globally in terms of the impacts of emitting carbon.
It's our Earth Day family meeting here on The Brian Lehrer Show, our Ask a Climatologist segment in full swing now with Catherine Mock from the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, and Amy in Manhattan here on WNYC. Happy Earth Day, Amy.
Happy Earth Day. I read several years ago that, that the oceans are absorbing about half of the CO2 emissions, but that this percentage was going up, and that the amount they can absorb is going to reach a saturation point at some time, and which means that the amount that stays in the atmosphere will double, and I'm wondering about how much that will accelerate the effects of carbon emissions.
Dr. Mock, a good specific science question.
So over 30% of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere by humans to date has indeed gone into the oceans. And actually, most of the heat that's being added to the climate system due to addition of these heat-trapping gases is going into the oceans. So what a lot of people say is that the ocean is growing hot and sour. And that has big biological impacts paired with a lot of use of the ocean that's happening through overfishing, boat traffic, etc. And we know that that combination of increasing temperatures in the ocean, increasing extreme temperatures near the surface, for example, in the tropics, paired with this becoming sour, becoming acidic, really does pose substantial risks to ocean life. Coral reefs, for example, are very at risk in the near term. Fisheries around the world are moving where fish occur. So in terms of going to catch fish, we might need to be going to substantially different locations in the future. And the reader also, or the caller also, alluded to the fact that the degree to which the oceans absorb carbon dioxide may change over time, which is correct. And finally, I would just point to, you know, geoengineering is often raised as a potential solution to climate change. And one of the biggest concerns about the sunlight deflection methods is that they don't actually get at this problem of the carbon dioxide going into the ocean and making it acidic.
Amy, thank you for that question. So I want to ask you something based on an earlier guest on the show who was from the Earth Institute at Columbia University, an organization that's very concerned about climate change and certainly thinks it's very real and that urgent action is necessary. But he was arguing against what he calls media hysteria regarding your IPCC report. And one of the things that he wrote in his Huffington Post article was what the media reports fail to mention is that deliberately slowing down the rate of economic growth to avert climate change could have similar, if not greater, negative health displacements and other violent impact. Unlike the media summaries, the IPCC report acknowledges the complexity of the threats posed by climate change, along with many other factors. So I wonder if you'd react to that specifically based on what you know is in this report with respect to any trade-offs between economic growth and climate change.
Great. So responding to climate change does not have to be very expensive, and it also does not have to be all about unfavorable trade-offs. What the report really shows is that responding to climate change can be a way to create a richer, more resilient world. So that response kind of takes two parts. First of all, there's reducing our emissions of heat-trapping gases. The report out last week showed that if we head towards some of the most ambitious mitigation scenarios, scenarios that would give us a very good chance of staying under a 2 degrees C increase above pre-industrial levels, so that's 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, we could get there, the models show, with only a shave off of annual economic growth of 0.06 percentage points. So that's almost a rounding error. And a way of thinking of that is that we would get to the total level of wealth in 2052 that we might get to in 2050 without climate change. So reducing our emissions doesn't have to be expensive, but what the report also really shows is that the longer you wait, the more expensive it becomes because more rapid action is needed. The second part is really becoming prepared for the impacts, and we could delve into that more as well.
What do you mean by that?
So even if we begin mitigating our emissions like crazy today, there, you know, technology is being scaled up, but we really haven't seen a dent in emissions. But let's say we do. Hopefully in the next few years, really start to mitigate emissions. Even if we do that, there is warming that is baked into the climate system due to our past emissions, due to infrastructure currently in place today. And so we actually kind of have responsibility for this warming that is in the pipeline no matter what we do. And we want to make sure that where climate change is already elevating risks in terms of coastal flooding, heat waves, heavy rain, where we know how we could be better prepared, that we do take steps to make sure we reckon with this increase in risk due to the warming that's baked into the climate system.
Here's a question that came in via our Facebook page from Jonathan, who asked about what's known as a stratoshield. And he asks, has any testing been done regarding atmospheric altitude displacement of greenhouse gas? I remember the topic being discussed on Freakonomics, he writes. One of the contributors said that pumping sulfur dioxide into a higher strata may have a cooling effect. Any truth to that claim? Asked Jonathan on Facebook. Are you familiar with this idea of stratoshield and pumping sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere as a coolant?
I am not familiar with that specific technique, but I think what the reports really clearly show is that there are a variety of ways we could geoengineer the climate. And some of those are, they sound straightforward, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But in terms of those carbon dioxide removal techniques, the technology is still at a stage where it definitely cannot be applied at scale. But within the century, some of those techniques may become more common, especially bioenergy paired with carbon capture and storage. Some of the other techniques really involve manipulation of the amount of sunlight that's entering into our atmosphere, sunlight deflection, or other methods that the caller or person on Facebook alluded to. And those, in some cases, will definitely, perhaps rather cheaply, reduce the amount of warming that the planet sees, but they come with trade-offs. So they affect the water cycle of the planet. They don't affect or don't reduce the amount of acidification that's happening in our oceans. And kind of importantly, if you stopped that technique at any one point, if you stop shooting particles into the stratosphere, warming could go up really rapidly with potentially severe risks.
Your report also includes positive impacts from global warming. Can you name a few?
Yep. We know that in some cases, disease vectors would change in a way that would reduce health impacts. There might be places where there's decreased mortality from cold. But what the report really shows overall is that in the balance, the negative impacts, the risks of downside consequences are much greater than the potential positive impacts. And that really holds looking across different types of impacts from climate change.
Do you conclude with any certainty, just to be clear, that the positives and the negatives do not balance out, that the good does not come close to equaling the bad?
Sure. I guess one place I could point to really specific data are in terms of projections for crop yields for the major crops through the coming century. So that's for wheat, corn, soy, rice. And what we see is that even for high warming at the end of the century, there are some crop areas where we would have increases in yield due to climate change. But those are actually greatly outweighed increasingly with the amount of temperature rise past 2050, especially by decreases in yield. So it happened for these major crops we're really dependent on. So the overall assessment is of substantial risks to food security with climate change interacting with increasing food demand, even though in some places you may still see increases in yields.
Why is that? And this answers a question that came up earlier on the show that I told everybody I was going to ask you about. If the planet is warming, why doesn't it just move the breadbasket, let's say, from the plain states of the United States into, you know, further north in the plains and into Canada, but it's the same growing area that we have now, only shifted north?
So there are a lot of people who are deep, deep experts in this exact topic. I'm not a food expert, but what I can say is that there are many different factors that influence the degree to which a crop produces a big yield. Temperature is one of them, but precipitation, humidity, extremes are really important in that. All of those factors were looked at in terms of, I think it was 1,090 projections for crop yields through the coming century. And the balance of those impacts was definitely negative. The risks are big. In fact, risks for food insecurity were identified as one of the key risks we should be considering in thinking about danger from climate change, especially the risks for those who would be most affected, those in poorer communities, in urban rural areas, and in low-latitude areas.
One more question on our Ask a Climatologist segment for our Earth Day family meeting. Dave in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
First of all, you're a gangster. You do an amazing job with the show. But I had a question. If the report addressed population shift due to the climate, the change in the weather is going to be so awful. Summers are already getting pretty bad. And, you know, possible, impact on resources and maybe positive effects on obesity due to the grain production being stifled a bit.
Maybe, and I want to ask the question that Dave posed to our screener originally, also because it makes the segue into our next topic. He had said he was going to ask, did the report address migration and demographic shifts as people move because they're forced to by climate? So go ahead and answer both questions.
Great. So in terms of migration, another advance in the literature in recent years is really looking at the degree to which climate change involves connections across all parts of the world. And we see those connections through trade. We see those connections through migration. And we know that climate change will increase some types of migration, displacement especially, being forced to move through increases in coastal flooding, for example. But migration can also be a positive. It can be a way to seek better opportunities. And I think being an American, many of us have parents or grandparents for whom that was the case. And so kind of understanding those complexities in terms of how climate change will affect people interacting across all parts of the world is a really deep and interesting part of the climate change challenge.
And there we leave it with our Ask a Climatologist segment. Catherine Mock, co-director of science for the International Panel on Climate Change, Working Group Number 2. She is based at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. Thank you so much. This has been so informative, and we really appreciate all your answers and all your time.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be on the show.